Hi, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of the SSP Early Career Publishing Podcast. I'm Sarah Grimmer from Digital Science, joined by Cell Press's Meredith Adenolfi. Hey, Meredith.
Hi, Sarah.
We're going to spend some time this year and next focusing on interviewing those individuals in publishing who have inspired us in the hopes that they will provide inspiration for you too. If there's anyone in the industry that you'd like to hear from, please get in touch with SSP by commenting on the Scholarly Kitchen post or emailing info@ssp.org. Today's guest is someone who I've personally admired for a long time, and when we decided to work on this series of interviews, was an easy choice for our first guest. We're joined by Magdalena Skipper, the first female editor-in-chief of Nature. I first worked with Magdalena as a young publisher when we launched the mega journal Scientific Reports. I was very young and experienced at the time and was really struck by Magdalena's kindness to me and her incredible knowledge across the editorial process. She was really inspiring to work with, and I wasn't at all surprised when she became the first female editor-in-chief of Nature. Welcome, Magdalena. It's great to have you here.
Hello, real pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So I'd like to start by asking for a quick introduction into who you are and what you do.
So I am Magdalena Skipper. I am editor-in-chief of Nature. The journal itself is, of course, a flagship journal of the Nature portfolio. And there is, in fact, a second part to my role. I am chief editorial advisor for the Nature portfolio. And the Nature portfolio consists of journals such as, for example, Nature Medicine, Nature Physics, Nature Water, Nature Communications, and many others, as well as other non-journal services that support researchers, for example, Nature Conferences or Nature Masterclasses. And in terms of what I do, my primary focus is on Nature itself. And of course, Nature is a weekly publication, although we publish really on a daily basis. And we publish essentially two types of content, magazine content, so news and opinion pieces, as well as research, original research, authored by researchers themselves. And as you can imagine, with the volume that we publish and frequency with we publish, the expertise of my team is really vast and incredibly deep. So I see myself more like a conductor of an orchestra, if you like, rather than a specialist in any specific area. Of course, I have my own background in terms of research. But the way I like to work and where I think I bring the greatest contribution to the journal is by tapping into the excellence of all my colleagues on the team and helping them come together.
So how many direct reports do you actually have?
So in terms of direct reports, there are only five. Each of them has a team of individuals. So the structure, Nature team, is quite structured. Another way to answer your question is there are just over 100 colleagues on my team who work directly on Nature.
Wow, so you're covering a tremendous breadth.
We certainly do. And in terms of the breadth that we cover at Nature, you know, I sometimes joke that for the vast majority of our history, which is over 150 years now, we were a multidisciplinary journal in the natural sciences. I use the past tense deliberately because we have in the recent years, most notably under my leadership, really expanded the focus of Nature and the breadth of Nature. So, of course, we continue to be very interested in publishing the natural sciences, but we now also publish clinical research, translational research, we publish social sciences, as well as applied sciences, and we're beginning to dabble in engineering. We should really do what it says on the cover of the journal and embrace all of these disciplines, all research across the disciplines. And of course, the beauty of a multidisciplinary journal is that it allows us to tap into the multidisciplinary collaborations, which of course are becoming more and more important in today's world.
Going back to your time in the lab, what inspired you or drew you towards a career in science?
You know, my inspiration to do science, to engage with science, actually goes back all the way to my childhood. In the very early days, I remember I was just fascinated by everything, all the living things around me. So I knew that I was going to be a biologist of some kind. It really fascinated me why things were the way they were. And I wanted to understand really the world as I saw it around me, with that focus on the living part of the world. And very quickly, you know, I was at school and I was learning more and more about different aspects of biology. The part of biological sciences that really fascinated me was genetics. Really quite early on, I think it was early days in high school, when I began to learn the very fundamentals of genetics, you know, why it is that children look a lot like their parents. And then, of course, that similarity sort of becomes more diluted, if you like, as you go through generations and further away in family connections. And that fascination, I think we all have that fascination to understand where we come from, why we are the way we are. And so for me, that was a very clear choice. So in fact, I studied genetics as my first degree and at university. That was University of Nottingham. That fascination of trying to understand and pick topics firsthand, if you like, made me think, okay, well, it's very clear. I have to go and try my hand at research. And so I went to do my PhD in Cambridge at the MRC LMB. And of course, it had to be in genetics. So my PhD is in very many ways classical genetics topic. I used C. elegans, which is this sort of little model organism, little worm that geneticists and biologists have developed into a model, enabling them to study different aspects of its biology. And I was attracted to a particular topic around sex determination in this little organism. And so, yeah, that's how I entered the world of science and the world of research, if you like.
And what was it that made you move away from working in the lab and move towards a career in publishing?
So I'm asked that question very often, and it's a very important question, I think. Sometimes the question is phrased slightly differently. So I'm asked, you know, why did you leave science and move to publishing? And I most emphatically state that I never left science. That's the beauty of being an editor.
And given the breadth of your job now, it seems that you would actually even potentially be closer to the science than you previously were.
Absolutely. So, of course, I initially, when I became an editor, I was more focused on genetics itself, on the discipline in which I had some experience and some knowledge. But for me, making that decision to move away from active research, part of that decision, or at the core of that decision fundamentally, was the desire to stay connected with science, with the research ecosystem. I never wanted to leave that. And that was very clear to me. What was also clear was that at that time, and I moved on to becoming a scientific editor after a postdoc. So after a PhD, I went to do a postdoc. And it was really the realization that for the vast majority of your research career, you have to be quite focused on a specific discipline to the exclusion of other interesting questions. Of course, as you become more senior in research, you can broaden your interests because at that point, often you have a lab, you have a number of individuals who work with you to address the questions you're interested in. But that's definitely not the case in the early stages of your career. And in fact, to be successful, to make a contribution to knowledge, you really have to focus on a question or a relatively narrowly focused set of questions. And I was simply too interested in too many different things. So I found it quite difficult to discipline myself to just focus on a smaller subset of questions. And it was that realization that, yes, I was very interested in research and I wanted to focus on that, but my focus needed to be broader, that led me to begin to explore other possibilities. And, you know, I have to be honest, I have to say, it's not like I dreamt of being an editor from an early age or anything like this, nothing like that at all. In fact, it was really a pure chance. I was in the lab, I was waiting for some incubation to finish, and I was flicking through a printed copy of Nature. And of course, at the back of Nature, there are classified ads, and there was an advert for a position of associate editor at Nature Reviews Genetics. At the time, that journal had just been launched. It was about 6 months old, and they were expanding the journal, and they wanted an additional member of the team. And I thought, oh, that sounds quite interesting. You know, genetics, they have a new journal. I'm just going to have a go and apply. And so I did, to be honest, not really knowing what an editor at a journal like that might be doing. And then what happened was that, and incidentally, that's also what happens today, is that when I was shortlisted, I was then sent a set of tests to do at home. And these tests really are elements of what an editor does during their working life. So there was an opportunity to edit a review, making suggestions to an author for how to improve a review article. There was an opportunity to write a short research highlight about a recently published paper, make suggestions for what kinds of reviews articles you would commission in the future, because Nature Reviews Journal's content is almost entirely commissioned by the editors, and a few other tasks. Well, it turned out that I loved these tasks so much that by the time I came to the interview, I was so enthusiastic about the job that, you know, it was basically impossible not to give me the job. That's at least how I think about it today.
Having worked in publishing for so long is not the kind of work that I imagine that suits everyone. But when it does, it must be a lifetime in many ways of fulfillment.
It certainly is. It's a very exciting opportunity and a very exciting niche within the research ecosystem. And, you know, forgive me my biologist's analogy, but I think it's an appropriate one. You know, I always make this analogy that as a researcher, you make those discoveries or develop new solutions, whatever, depending on the type of research that you do. And if it's discovery that you engage in, you discover something that nobody has ever seen before in the whole history of the universe and humanity, or nobody's ever described it before. And that's incredibly exciting. Now, as an editor, I see myself as standing right behind you as you make those discoveries, looking over your shoulder. And that, to me, is also a very exciting and privileged position because, of course, to continue this metaphor, I stand behind many shoulders, seeing many more discoveries than I could ever contribute to myself.
And on that note, were there any really noteworthy discoveries that you were involved in?
You know, this was such a long time ago. You know, I left the lab more than 20 years ago now. Of course, I made a contribution, but I like to think that I have made more of a contribution as an editor over the years, supporting researchers, making those discoveries and supporting them in appropriately disseminating these discoveries. That is more worthwhile focusing on at this stage in my career.
Were there any moments in science as part of your role that you were at the forefront of?
Let me give a couple of examples. You know, from today's perspective, of course, as editor-in-chief of Nature, my team supports many different discoveries right across disciplines. So in some way, although I am not directly involved in handling of those papers or commenting on those papers, of course, I support the team, and then team enables dissemination of that research. And of course, in recent years, you know, probably the story that is very much still unfolding in research that everyone talks about today is, of course, the James Webb Space Telescope. So much information is coming out of this, really a new way for us to look at the universe out there. But to go back in history a little bit, when I myself was a manuscript handling editor at Nature, then I was focused on genetics and genomics because that is my research background, as I explained, and that's how we work at Nature. So the editors on my team, the editors who handle manuscripts, the research editors, they will handle manuscripts in the discipline in which they have some research background, which of course stands to reason. They need to be able to evaluate the manuscripts, evaluate the reviewers' comments, indeed invite those reviewers, and so on and so on. So just to give you a couple of examples, during the time when I was manuscript editor for genetics and genomics at Nature, I guess three main things really happened to the field. The first one, I would say, was really a realization of how to tackle complex genetics in any organism, but especially in the human. And of course, I'm referring to the genome-wide association studies, which is effectively a statistical approach to assessing association of elements in the genome with particular phenotype, whether it's disease phenotype or just a normal, if you like, phenotype such as height. And so that was really the beginning, the real wave of these genome-wide association studies giving us the first robust insights into this incredibly complex genetic architecture that underlies these traits. So that would be the first example. The second example was that of harnessing genomics, so genome sequencing now, in the context of cancers. Our ability to characterize different cancers and dissect their types and subtypes, which of course is crucial for their treatment, in a large part can be traced down to the ability to sequence these cancer samples from many, many different patients. I think that was an incredibly exciting development that, of course, continues, but it sort of happened during the time when I was a manuscript editor and at Nature, I handled many of these papers. And the final example that I will give is, again, a very large effort that actually had many waves of funding, involved an extremely large number of labs, institutes, and researchers, of course. And that's the ENCODE project. So this was an encyclopedia of coding elements in the genome. And this was an incredibly collaborative, concerted effort to really decode these regulatory elements in the genome. There was a series of programs. ENCODE was probably the largest of them, as I say, unfolded in a number of waves to specifically tackle that and give us an understanding of what was previously referred to as the dark matter of the genome. So just a few examples. And thank you, by the way, for giving me the opportunity to go back in time, because I, even today, I'm still very excited about these papers that I handled back then, which is now, you know, several years ago.
And I wonder if people actually realize, I think many will, but many will also not realize how editors really are at the forefront of scientific discovery. And I think that's really what I wanted to get to with that question, which is where we got. You are looking at an enormous breadth of research coming across your desk and really getting to make key decisions that determine what happens to that research and ensuring the safe dissemination of it, which is tremendously exciting.
Yes, I think that's an important thing to stress and to point out. You know, editors always talk about their papers, the papers they published. Of course, the names are not on the papers because clearly that's not appropriate. But there is that pride and sense of ownership and care about these papers, which they really shepherd from submission to publication. And of course, that happens through judicious choice of reviewers also. And that choice of reviewers is dictated by the desire to, of course, test the robustness of the claims in the paper, but also the desire to improve those papers so that they may be published and have the greatest impact possible. So in that sense, you know, one can think of almost a companionship between the groups of authors and the editors on that journey.
That's a really nice way to put it. And during your time as a researcher, or potentially in your editorial role, who was it who inspired you or motivated you?
You know, I do not have one mentor or one inspiration in my life. There are actually very many. And it always surprises me when I look back and think who inspired me in life. It always surprises me how I actually draw inspiration from many different people, many different situations, many different circumstances. And often it's the little vignettes and little stories that they share with me or things that I observe about them that inspire me and makes me think, oh, you know, that if I could, that would be great to emulate this in some way. And so it's a real mixture of individuals and circumstances. You know, I remember a few years back, it was actually back in 2018, I was one of the group of colleagues who launched the Nature Award for Inspiring Women in Science. And that award is designed to indeed reward these women who are outstanding in their research, but also inspirational in many other ways. But these women are early career researchers. So the award is for those who are not later in the career than 10 years from the PhD. And I remember the first cohort because, you know, this was the first year. We didn't really know what to expect. And I was reading through these nominations. Today, the award is by application. Back then, in the first year, it was nominations. I was reading through these nominations of these absolutely incredible women who were much younger than me at the time, who were early career researchers. And I was humbled and so inspired. And literally, I remember thinking to myself, what have I done with my life? These women are just amazing. And, you know, another source of inspiration, actually completely unrelated to science, was this British woman who in the 1930s traveled by herself in Central Asia, which I imagine must have been very difficult. She's called Rosita Forbes, and she wrote her memoirs. And I just was very inspired by this woman who was completely undeterred by expectations of the society around her. And she just thought, well, I'm just going to go ahead and do this because I enjoy meeting new people and being immersed in new cultures. So there are many, many different inspirations. But for me, the important thing is that I actually look for them everywhere. It doesn't have to be famous people or people who are towards the end of their career stage. You know, sometimes it's actually the people who are at the youngest, earliest stages of their career I meet today who really inspire me.
Thanks very much, Magdalena. I think that's such a good answer and so important for all of us to remember, myself included. I think we forget sometimes to look so broadly for our inspiration or our motivation. I'm now going to hand over to Meredith, who'll ask you a few more questions.
Thanks, Sarah. So Magdalena, there's a lot we could do with the direction of this conversation, but I want to switch gears a little bit and go back to your editor-in-chief role and talk a little bit about your career path at Nature. So maybe let's just start with, if you can tell us a little bit about sort of how you got to editor-in-chief. So basically what happened between that handling editor job and where you are now?
So as I mentioned earlier, I started my editing life as an editor at Nature Reviews Genetics. And I then became chief editor of that journal. I was there for about 7 years. And after that, I switched to Nature itself to be a manuscript handling editor, as I described earlier. And I was in that role for about 7 years as well. And again, it was that itch to learn more about other aspects of research that propelled me to the next step, actually. And so my next step was to move away from handling manuscripts or commissioning and to become executive editor for a new group of journals that we were launching at the time. They're called Nature Partner Journals. And this was an opportunity for me to begin to talk to researchers in physics, in earth sciences, in chemistry, in other aspects of biology, also medicine. Understandably, of course, my interaction with these fields was unfolding at a different level, not in as much detail as I was involved in with the geneticists that I used to work with, but it enabled me to broaden my scope even further. And then fast forward a little bit, that actually enabled me to become editor-in-chief of Nature Communications, which of course is a little bit like Nature in terms of its scope. So it's a multidisciplinary journal that publishes right across disciplines. Of course, the journal has a different bar and it publishes many more papers as a very large team of manuscript editors. And that was really at the time that I further engaged with a number of disciplines through the managers on my team, trying to understand the different preoccupations of different researchers in different disciplines, different stages of, you know, discipline development, or how it's interesting to consider that, of course, disciplines are not frozen in time. They also emerge in and of themselves. And then so ultimately that led me to my current role in which I've been for just over 5 years.
Yeah, that's amazing to hear about all those steps. And as you probably know, a large part of our audience are early career professionals in scholarly publishing. So I think they would be really interested to hear about sort of personally for you, if you're able to talk about this, how you sort of found the courage and the belief in yourself to go for the big jobs, right? The editor-in-chief for Nature Communications, and then ultimately the job you're in now. Were you always confident about that step, or what did you kind of have to do to get to that point for yourself?
So I suppose the shortest answer probably to your question is that whenever I applied for these jobs, I was always convinced that I wouldn't get the job. So in some way, that conviction maybe alleviated some of the pressure of applying for the job. So it wasn't definitely, it was not the case that, you know, I had the confidence to say, oh, of course, I am the person for the job. I've never had that sense or that conviction. Another thing that I would say is, you know, my career path is not necessarily particularly linear or particularly directed. So I've always made choices guided by the things that really interest me. Perhaps because I know that I can't do something I'm not very interested in, or rather I'll be very bad at doing something I'm not interested in. So the most important thing for me was to do something that really motivates me, that I have a lot of enthusiasm for and interest. And so in each case, I applied for these roles because I felt that I had something to contribute. And then the application process became sort of an exercise in convincing others, those who were interviewing me for these roles, that I did have something to contribute and that contribution was going to be worthwhile. I think that's probably how I think about it.
There's so much in your answer there that I want to follow up on, but specifically I'm interested in this piece you said about sort of not thinking that you were going to get these jobs and that kind of increasing your ability to go for them in a way, because you almost weren't set on an outcome. You just thought, I have something to contribute. Let me try it. It's often considered sort of a weakness that women are less likely to go for jobs they don't think they can get or that they don't think they're fully qualified for. But it sounds like you kind of were able to make that into a strength that kind of gave you the courage to actually do it.
Of course, this is just an interpretation that I gave you. I definitely feel that there is something to what I said. The way I thought about these roles, I have considered how others have done these jobs before. In almost all cases, these jobs existed before. And, you know, what would I continue with? What would I discontinue? What would be my way of doing it? And then I guess now this is my personal quality. I have an opinion about everything. I have now learned not necessarily to share it on all occasions, but that's something that comes with age. But because I have these opinions, I guess I felt that applying for a job would give me an opportunity to make those suggestions and share my vision. And then if my vision is not appreciated and doesn't quite align with what the others want, then so be it. It's an interesting question to consider. And of course, completely recognize what you say about women not necessarily wanting to put themselves forward. What is useful to consider, I think, one aspect or one step is to think about the courage to put yourself forward. And then the second thing to consider is, assuming you are selected for whatever it is, whether it's a role or a job or a situation, what next? How will you feel in those shoes? And I have to say, in having courage to take the first step, I maybe have not always thought about the second step as carefully as I should have done. But then perhaps my attitude to being more collaborative and not being afraid of saying, I don't know something, I need some help and support, has carried me through in those situations.
There's so much great advice in there about how to approach situations like this. And it kind of leads me to my next question, which is, I think, a follow from what we've been talking about. But what has it been like for you being the first woman in this editor-in-chief job? Have you noticed that having an impact, the fact that you are the first? What impact has that had? And anything else you would sort of note from that part of the experience?
You know, it's an important and interesting question that perhaps is better answered by others. Because, of course, you know, this is probably the most difficult question anyone can be asked, and that is evaluate oneself in a situation, because by definition, this cannot be objective. What I can say is not so much anymore, but when I started, I did perceive surprise in others because they perhaps imagined editor-in-chief of Nature in a slightly different way. Undoubtedly, this is shaped by the fact that all my predecessors, of whom there have not been actually that many, I'm only the eighth editor-in-chief of Nature in its 154 years history, which is a peculiarity in itself. But all of them, of course, have been men. So that's perhaps the most striking thing, that to begin with, I did feel I had to overcome a certain preconceived expectation of what an editor-in-chief of Nature would say or how they would behave or what they would be like. Today, 5 years on, I think it's a little bit different. You know, nothing happens in a vacuum, and I have an incredibly talented and supportive team as well, which of course helps me to represent them, but also helps me carry out together with them some of the things that I really want to champion and drive. And, you know, for example, in recent years, we've been paying a lot of attention to diversity and inclusion in research itself, in terms of the research topics, but also in research as in the community. So, you know, who does research and what research, what questions are asked by those who do the research, just as an example.
Yeah, thank you. There's so many more questions we could ask here, but I'm conscious that you've already been very generous with your time. So I have one more that I want to ask you to kind of close the conversation. And that's just generally speaking, what advice would you give to others in the industry? And thinking here again about our audience being largely early career professionals, I'm sure there are going to be a lot of women listening to this who are early in their careers and are inspired by sort of the path you've taken and the advice you've given. Do you have any other sort of general nuggets of advice you'd like to give?
So I would say maybe two categories of advice, I suppose. One is a piece of advice to individuals, regardless of whether they are researchers or publishing professionals or anyone for that matter. I do think that the best way to make your career choices is to focus on what makes you happy, what gets you out of bed, in other words. If you are passionate about something, if you're interested in something, you will make a contribution to whatever it is that you've chosen, whatever it is that you're passionate about. And it doesn't really matter what other people expect of you. The most important thing is that you feel right with your choices. And that's something that I've come to believe very strongly over the years. You know, just to give you one example to illustrate this, when I moved from being chief editor of Nature Reviews Genetics to being a manuscript editor at Nature, there were actually colleagues who said to me, oh, that was a bit of a strange move because really you've taken a step down. You were running a journal and now you're just one of many on the journal. And I thought, you know, it's very interesting. I never thought of it in that way. I just felt that it was a different way of interacting as an editor with the research community that would help me grow and, you know, do fun things, but also would enable me to support the community in a different way. So that's just one example. The second type of advice that I would give is more to, you know, use the word industry, which as an editor, I actually use very rarely, but that's just the detail. But my advice is really to the publishers, the editors, the researchers, the funders, whoever who is part of this ecosystem, part of the wider research community who may be listening to this, and that is collaborate. We are all part of the same ecosystem. We're all part of the same environment, the same community. We're all striving for the same thing. And sometimes it feels like we're pulling in different directions. And that doesn't serve anyone. And it actually makes our lives miserable. Of course, each one of us thinks through a lens of our profession. Each of us has a focus. But let's pull together and let's think how we can collaborate and synergize on the different strengths within the community. Everyone will be better for it, I think.
I'm so glad you brought up this point, because I've been thinking a lot lately about just the need, even just across publishers in the industry, to collaborate and come together rather than seeing it each as our own individual problem. It's much more powerful when you're actually working on problems together. And as you said, we're all trying to get to the same place ultimately.
Agreed.
Well, thank you so much, Magdalena, for being generous with your time and talking to us. There's so much great stuff in this conversation. Just a brief time, we got really a lot of great insight and advice. So we really appreciate it. And thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
We want to thank Magdalena for taking the time to be here and talk to us. There are so many different directions I could go in terms of highlighting takeaways from this conversation, but instead, I think we're just going to let the interview speak for itself and leave it here to allow our audience to reflect on everything that you have inevitably gotten out of hearing from Magdalena. We're so grateful to have this space to highlight the most inspiring and motivating voices in our industry, and it truly doesn't get any more inspiring than Magdalena. As Sara mentioned earlier, we'd love your feedback and suggestions on who you'd like to hear from or what you'd like to hear about in future episodes. So please feel free to drop us a line at info@sspnet.org or leave us a comment on the Scholarly Kitchen post. Thank you so much for listening, and Sara and I will be back soon with our next episode.